Yo, Short Box Nation, this is Botter clocking in with a very quick announcement to make before we get on with the show. I'll be in Chicago attending C2E2, and if you'll be in Chicago attending the convention too, it means that you have a very unique opportunity to attend a live podcast show like never before. I'll be hosting a comic podcast crossover live show on Friday, April 26th. I'm going to be joined by very good friends of the show and frequent guest co-hosts like Chris Hacker from the Oblivion Bar podcast and Greg Ligtig from the First Issue Club. We're recording a live podcast show that's celebrating the best comics of the year so far. We're going to talk about the creators that are absolutely crushing it. And considering the people involved with the panel, you can expect a great time. You can expect the typical brand of comedy and entertainment. If you ever heard any of the other episodes where Chris and Greg have been guest co-hosts, you can expect that on steroids. So once again, if you're attending C2E2 this weekend and you're looking for something to do or you need a break from the convention floor and standing in lines, I highly encourage you to come sit in for this live podcast show taking place the Friday morning of the convention at 11:15 a.m. I'll have links to the room and the rest of the panel information in the show notes. So check that out if you'll be in Chicago. Come on out, sit in on the panel, and have a good time. Hopefully I get to meet you. With that being said, let's get this show started. In this episode of The Short Box.
Me coming up in Brooklyn in the 80s, like, you know, New York was pretty messed up. Like, we was looking for somebody to come save us. You know, like, Spider-Man was real, like, New York City based, street level. Daredevil, you know, like, street level. Like, the Frank Miller stuff was, like, really gritty and really relatable. Even a comic book like Cloak and Dagger, you know what I'm saying? It was kind of, like, born out of the 80s and the drug epidemic in the 80s. So I think a lot of that was kind of like intertwined. You know, I think comic books gave us the fantasy. And in hip-hop too, hip-hop was just the way out. It was a way for us to kind of better our circumstances, to imagine a better version of ourselves, to imagine some type of growth or like upward mobility. Hip-hop had always been aspirational.
Ladies and gentlemen, I present to you the Short Box Podcast.
Season 9.
It's a mute, yo,
Yo, check this shit out.
About to drop that comic book talk show that brings you the best.
The Short Box Radio.
The Short Box Podcast is recorded live from Jacksonville, Florida.
Yo, Short Box Nation, welcome back to the podcast. If you're new to the show, welcome. My name is Botter, and this is the Short Box Podcast, the comic book talk show that brings you the best conversations about comic books and pop culture inspired by comics. This is episode 411, and today we're talking about the intersection of hip-hop and comic books, which I believe there is a strong connection between the two. I think it's safe to say that a lot of you probably feel the same way as well if you're a fan of the show or the music that we play or some of the guests that we've had on. And it doesn't really take a scientist or genius to see that there is a strong, you know, synergy between the two. Hip-hop culture has always embraced the profound storytelling and cool visuals that can be found in comic books. I mean, some of the most successful and recognizable rappers and hip-hop acts in the world have adopted and based alter egos and stage names on recognizable comic characters. From Method Man calling himself Johnny Blaze to Ghostface Killah adopting the Tony Stark alias, look no further than the DJ group The Executioners, who originally went by the X-Men. I mean, look no further than the late, great MF Doom, you know, hip-hop's biggest villain. Or look at someone like Czarface, who is extremely active in releasing music, but also incorporates a lot of comic book aesthetic and design in everything he does. And if you want examples of comic books making that crossover, look at someone like Bill Sienkiewicz, right? One of the industry's most profound and revered storytellers and artists. He's done so many iconic hip-hop covers. I mean, there's a few that I've learned for the first time just recently. And I think the argument makes itself when you look at what Marvel did in 2015 with the now infamous hip-hop cover series. I mean, that was a watershed moment for them. It was major. I know I was collecting every single cover that I could. I say all that to say hip-hop and comic books, they go together, like PB&J, like white Air Force Ones and white tees. And to help me drive that point home is why we have our guest of honor today. In my opinion, he's a walking personification of these two worlds. His name is Rob Markman, and aside from being a legendary hip-hop journalist, He's currently the VP of Genius, a digital media company that houses the world's biggest collection of song lyrics and musical knowledge. He's also the co-host of Rotation Roundtable on Amazon Music, which just wrapped up its first season. But before he ever landed any of these major prestigious roles, he cut his teeth in journalism. He was the former co-deputy editor of XXL Magazine in the late 2000s, and he's probably written hundreds, if not thousands, of music news articles and album reviews for publications and platforms like Scratch Magazine, Complex, The Source, and MTV, just to name a few. And speaking of his pen game, he's also an established rapper himself. He's got three full-length albums under his belt, all put out under his own record label and imprint, A Right to Dream. And to tie it back to comic books, he's also a published comic book writer. He's written short stories for both Marvel and DC, and just last year he wrote the graphic novel Flatbush Zombies 3001, a prequel odyssey which was put out by Z2 Comics, which he's doing a signing for on December 2nd at Bulletproof Comics in Brooklyn. As you can tell, we could be here all day just talking about his accomplishments and accolades, but trust me when I say he is the perfect guest to have for this episode. Shortbox Nation, without further ado, let's welcome Rob Markman to the show. Hey, Rob, welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
I'm doing good. I'm doing good, man. I'm glad that we finally, we've been talking about this for a minute through Instagram and DM, and then, you know, we connected at Comic-Con real quick. So I'm glad we finally was able to make this happen.
Same, man. This is an interview I've been looking to make happen, and that panel that you did at New York Comic-Con, the hip-hop and comic book panel, I was curious, man, like, how was it hosting a panel of the likes of Sanford Green? You know, I mentioned Bill Sienkiewicz, but you also had DMC from Run DMC. You had Alex Alonzo on the panel as well. How's that experience for you personally?
Nah, that was amazing. That was a dream come true. Shout out to my man, Riggs Morales, fellow hip hop legend, like comic book fan. He put that together, really. He works very closely with DMC and Daryl Makes Comics. And he put that together and asked me if I could moderate. It came together really quickly. I'm glad people got so much out of it. I was nervous that maybe we didn't have enough prep time, like just the regular nerves of doing something that big. I never, you know, I remember going to New York Comic Con as a kid, and as a fan always, but I had never been a part of it in an official capacity like that. So that panel was huge. It was amazing. It was a super honor to be a part of that.
Yeah, man. Kudos to you. Like I said, I came on the pod immediately and was just talking about how amazing that experience was. In the middle of the panel, I just looked around. I was like, I think I might be in heaven. Like, I am witnessing like my two worlds come together. And learning so much about Bill Sienkiewicz was insane. Like, I knew he had a lot of ties to a lot of classic hip hop albums, but I didn't know that he did like the EPMD album cover or the T.I. album cover as well. So I got a lot out of that panel, like learning all the different things that Bill Sienkiewicz did and, you know, Sanford Green chiming in and the respect he had for them. Was there anything that you got out of that panel that was maybe like a light bulb moment or something new for you?
I don't know if there was anything necessarily new that I learned because, you know, we just researched a lot going into it. But it was just surreal. Like, I mean, you know, I was already into comic books because of my older brother and had some comic books of my own by the time EPMD came out with Business as Usual and Bill Sienkiewicz did that cover. And I remember my older brother had the EPMD tape and I hadn't put two and two together. Like, I didn't know that was Bill Sienkiewicz. I didn't know that was a comic book artist, but I knew I was always drawn to that EPMD cover. And it was years later that I realized that it was Bill Sienkiewicz. And I had known he did the TI, but you know, it was great. Axel talking about the hip hop variant covers and how that came about. I love Sanford Green talking about his experience. It was just a great panel all around. It wasn't necessarily like a light bulb moment or anything like that I had particularly learned that I didn't know, but in doing the research for it, it was really dope.
And, you know, I gave some examples of, you know, why I think there is that cross section between hip hop and comics, but I was curious to hear from someone that's, you know, worked professionally in both worlds, like, why does hip hop and comics, why is it kind of seamless together? Why, like, what, in your words, like, what is that connection between the two cultures?
I don't know. You know, for us, it was me coming up in Brooklyn in the 80s, like, you know, New York was pretty messed up. You know what I'm saying? Like, like we was looking for somebody to come save us. And, you know, I think comic books gave us the fantasy, you know, especially things that, you know, there were a lot of things going on. Like when I was coming up, like Spider-Man had always been my favorite, but Spider-Man was like street level as much as he battled, you know, like Spider-Man was real, like New York City based street level, Daredevil. You know, like street level, like the Frank Miller stuff was like really gritty and really relatable. Even a comic book like Cloak and Dagger, you know what I'm saying? It was kind of like born out of the 80s and the drug epidemic in the 80s. So I think a lot of that was kind of like intertwined. And in hip hop too, hip hop was just a way out. It was a way for us to kind of better our circumstances, to imagine, a better version of ourselves, to imagine some type of growth or like upward mobility. Hip hop had always been aspirational. So there's a degree of fantasy in hip hop as well. Like there is in comic books. So to me, that was the connection, at least for my generation and kids where I grew up in my eyes, you know.
That is well said. And I've always felt that one of the earliest things that, you know, when you think about the early architects of Marvel, you know, your Stan Lee's, your Jack Kirby's, your Steve Ditko's, I always felt that their decision to base a majority, if not all of the Marvel universe within New York, was probably one of the smartest things they could have done, right? Like it gives like that real world attachment for some readers to like have a city and a reference and feel like, you know, especially for folks that live in New York, to feel like, oh, wow, I know that place. You know, I know these references. I always felt like that was such a smart decision early on that, you know, really helped them like build a fan base and a dedicated fan base.
Yeah, you know, look, and I'm biased because I'm from New York, so it was absolutely relatable for me to open the page and see things that I've recognized. But, you know, I think it just helps to root the story in something real. You know, DC, I feel like, maybe had a harder time. You know, Gotham City, it's such an amazing concept. Like, it's pure fantasy. I think within the Batman universe, what Gotham City represents, I think they did a great job of the myth of Batman and making that feel very real. And we've seen it in the movies and stuff, but you know, I don't know if we feel that same way about Metropolis, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think Gotham is like an example of when you get it right, when you try to build something, totally fantasy, but yeah, I get my choice. I'm going to root it in something real.
And speaking about real places, you know, I mentioned in the intro that you're doing a signing at Bulletproof Comics on December 2nd. And I believe comic artist Damian Scott will be there as well. I understand that shop has not only history and significance to the neighborhood, to Brooklyn, you know, but what does Bulletproof Comics like mean to you specifically? I understand that you were going there since a kid, right?
Yeah, man. Shout out to Hank, who owns, you know, Bulletproof, and my guy Randy over there and the whole team at Bulletproof. Bulletproof, I believe, opened in 1992 in a place that's called the Flatbush Junction, which is where Flatbush meets Nostrand Avenue. It's right by Brooklyn College. Look, the thing when I was growing up, there were no comic book stores in our neighborhoods. We used to cop them. You know, we used to get the newsstand versions. You know, I grew up with Damian Scott, who's now a comic book artist, my best friend, it's my brother. And we used to go to stores like Optimo and Stop One and the grocery stores, literally like off the spinner racks, buying newsstand versions of comics because we didn't have comic book stores close to us. You know, as we started getting older and was able to explore the city more, we would find comic shops, different comic shops in Brooklyn, Comics Plus, which was on 7th Avenue and Park Slope. There were a couple of comic stores in Coney Island. Brain Damage was a comic store that I actually worked at. But like Bulletproof was like in the hood. Like we could walk the Bulletproof. Like it was just like so close. And so it was like, yo, somebody put a comic book store in the hood. Like, and it just felt like, cause you know, when you used to get them off the newsstand, you know, the guys at the corners, they didn't take care of the books. There was no bags and boards. There was, you know, you just kind of bought the comic book as is, but going into a local comic book shops, it's like, that's where they specialized in. That's where they had back issues. It was just a whole different experience. So when Bulletproof opened in Flatbush, Brooklyn, it meant everything to us. And to go back there now as an adult and do a signing there with the Flatbush Zombies is like, it's just amazing.
Oh, that's incredible. When you think back to like those early years of, you know, collecting comic books where you could from these convenience stores and such, what are some of the titles that you were collecting? What were some of the creators, artists, or writers that you were looking out for?
Yeah, definitely Spider-Man was number one. Amazing Spider-Man, Web of Spider-Man, Spectacular Spider-Man, anything with Spider-Man on it. You know, I first probably came in right when Todd McFarlane was making his mark on Spider-Man. So Todd McFarlane has always been my favorite artist. And around the same time, I mean, this is Jim Lee making his mark on X-Men. So for me, it was mainly Spider-Man and X-Men titles that I was copying from the newsstand.
You mentioned, you know, being pretty good friends with, like, you know, Damian Scott obviously said, you know, he's like your brother to you. I understand you're real good friends with Sanford Green. Have you had a chance to meet, like, some of your other, like, comic icons, like a Todd McFarlane or Jim Lee?
Nah. And Sanford Green, I actually just met Sanford for the first time at the Comic-Con. And we had a good time together. Young Guru would always tell me about him. And, you know, I knew who Sanford was, but Young Guru was like, nah, like, you got to check this out. He's a really big comic book head, too. But not really. I mean, Damian, I grew up with. So Damian, I met Damian. I was 6 years old. He's a couple of years older than me. So I think I was six. He was eight. Our sisters were friends. And so we used to hang out because of our sisters and then we became best friends. You know, I haven't really formed a relationship with very many comic creators. You know, some that I hope happens, but it hasn't happened, but Damian for sure. Axel, I knew previously to the panel. I had taken years, a couple of meetings with Axel. Chris Robinson, who's a former editor over at Marvel. I met and kicked it with. Oh my God, you're gonna kill me. There's a comic book artist also that I grew up with, Jamal Eagle.
Oh,
is another one. Yeah. He grew up around the corner. From me, my mother used to babysit for him. So he used to hang out at my crib all the time. But these are guys that I knew before they became comic book artists, you know. And then when I was a kid going to conventions, like meeting like I have like Rob Liefeld autographs from like 91, you know what I'm saying? And stuff like that. So, but now I haven't gotten a chance to meet Todd McFarlane yet or anything like that.
It seems that you were still very active in the comic book space. I was scrolling through your Instagram and I was like, oh, damn, there's quite a few comic book posts on here. Like you posted a couple of what I can only assume is pickups from New York Comic Con. But you had a Dark Knight number 2 CGC graded signed by Frank Miller. I think I seen a Hulk 181 in there. You posted a Ghost Rider 15 cover, like that iconic holographic foil one. What is your collection like nowadays? Like, are you still pretty active in terms of buying comics? And are there any significant, you know, major holy grails in that collection?
The Dark Knight number 2 was actually in my collection. And Frank Miller did a signing at Bulletproof. And,
oh, cool.
And so I got it signed and it was a CGC event. So I actually just picked it up. But it was actually my book that I had. Hulk 181 was my grail, first appearance of Wolverine.
Classic.
Really not the first appearance of Wolverine. Hulk 180 is the first appearance of Wolverine. I debate that. I mean, in Hulk 180, he comes out in the last panel, it was a full body shot, and he says, I am the Wolverine. If that's not the first appearance. But, you know, what CGC and what I guess the collector world recognizes as the first appearance of Wolverine is 181. But that was my grail, but... At New York Comic Con this year, I bought a Hulk 180. I bought a raw copy of that, and I bought a slab copy of 181. And so those are probably my grails right now. I got my eye on a few others. You know, I want a giant size X-Men 1. I really consider getting giant size X-Men 1 at New York Comic Con. That'll probably be the next one.
Yo, this is Botter. Sorry for interrupting this episode, but I'll keep it brief. I wanted to let you know about a massive sale we have going on over at the Short Box Store on all of our merchandise and apparel. That's theshortboxstore.bigcartel.com. You can now save 20% off your entire order using the discount code YO, YOO. So if you've been waiting for the right time to finally buy that gauntlet snapback, or if you ever wanted to buy any of the shirts you see me wear on the podcast, well, now's your chance to get them for a steal. We still have a few sizes left of everything, but they won't last long. And once they're gone, they are gone. And then I mentioned that all of our apparel is screen printed on high quality material. None of that heat transfer or direct to garment stuff. Our shirts are some of the most comfortable ones you'll ever wear. And the hats look even better in person. So wear your support for the Short Box Nation proudly, knowing that you're going to look damn good doing it. Get to theshortboxstore.bigcartel.com as soon as you can
And don't forget to use that discount code YOO to save 20% off your entire order. All of this information can be found in this episode's show notes if you want to get there faster. Thanks for not pressing fast forward. Now back to the show. There are certain holy grails that just kind of, you know, are easy to like name, right? It's like Giant Size X-Men 1, if you can get your hands on a, you know, Batman 1 or Action Comics. But Giant Size X-Men 1, I know for me personally, has like a sentimental value to it too, just because that's one of the first books my dad gave me. And I feel like that is a book you could still give to someone today that might have all this X-Men history. It's still a book that I think stands the test of time, you know?
Wow. So your dad passed you down a Giant Size X-Men 1?
And I don't know if that Giant Size X-Men 1 is an OG or maybe like a one of those reprint. I think they reprinted it a few times, but I want to say it's a reprint because I would probably cry if I found out that, you know, my little greasy fingers are all over an OG copy. And I want to say he got a lot of his books from like, you know, corner store spinner racks. So he never really got into that collector mindset. So he's got a bunch of awesome, you know, think books that you would consider grails now, but he never kept in a bag and board. You know, like I remember growing up, he had this old wooden VCR cabinet and just comics stacked up, you know, just beat to death.
Nah, but that's cool. That's dope too. It's okay that he didn't take care of them. Like the fact that he still has them.
Oh, yeah.
And are able to pass down are cool. It's cool as hell. But yeah, you know, a lot of my collection is from stuff that I bought. You know, I'm like a late 80s, early 90s. You know, that's my sweet spot. So a lot of the stuff is stuff that I bought. Most of my collection is stuff that I bought off either the newsstand or our comic stores that I was collecting back then. But yeah, no, I got some dope ones, some dope like modern keys in my collection. Like I have a New Mutants 87.
Deadpool.
I'm sending it off to CGC now. I was just speaking to my guy who has a CGC account. He's sending it off for me, but I'm sending a Spider-Man 300 first appearance of Venom. Because we also know
I feel
that,
like now you're just bragging. Now you're just bragging, Rob. All right, I get it.
New Mutants 98 that I got. I bought that in real time. First appearance of Deadpool. First appearance of Carnage. Amazing Spider-Man 361. I probably have like 4 or 5 copies of those. So, you know, yeah. Those are like some of my most kind of prized possessions. First appearance of Gambit. I think that was Uncanny X-Men 266, if I'm not mistaken. But also there's the debate of the X-Men Annual 14, which one is really the first appearance of Gambit. So I got both of them.
You know, that debate gets brought up a lot is what qualifies as a first appearance. You know, what separates a first full appearance versus like a cameo? And some books will go ahead and start a whole online argument. You know, we're talking like 20 page threads of people going back and forth. And that's definitely one of them.
Yeah. Shout out to my man, Chris at Cheddar Comics. Is an IG account that I follow and I buy stuff. I gotten a lot of cool stuff from Chris. He did a YouTube video about it. But he asked Chris Claremont directly, like, well, which one is the first appearance? The whole thing is right. Like,
yeah,
they intended for the Uncanny X-Men issue to be the first appearance, but they jumped the gun and put out the annual before. But I think even Chris said, technically, it's the annual. Like, if you're going by the letter of the law, the annual was the first time that people saw him, despite what I intended. You know what I'm saying? Like, the first time people saw Gambit. Look, again, in the annual, he appeared in about 10 panels. They called him by name. You know, like, it was the first time people saw him, even if they were confused. You know what I mean?
Man, talk about a way to shut down that argument. It's going right directly to the source. The man that introduced it. That's wild.
Yeah.
Are you collecting like current comic books? Are there any titles that you're reading now? Do you have a pull list or do you even have time?
Just because I've been so busy, I haven't had time. I don't have a current pull list. I just kind of go and pick up what I like in real time or a couple of things. I'm about to get back into it, though, as I settle down. What really keeps me current, though, is the Marvel Unlimited app. So I just read everything.
Best bang for your buck. You know, like I'm always saying support your local comic shops, but you cannot go wrong also having any of the Marvel Unlimited app or the DC app too.
Yeah, I got to get the DC one. But the Marvel Unlimited I have, so I'm reading. You know, the last thing, honestly, that I probably collected like issue for issue was Running Back to the Storm and was excited about was the X-Men relaunch, The Power of X. And those were dope. And then to me, X-Men after that, just the relaunch of all the X-Men, the Excalibur, the Fallen Angels after like Power of X and that whole crossover. I thought that those books were amazing. And then when they just lost me, the whole Krakoa.
If we're being real, once Hickman left, it was like, for me, a sign of like, I think I'm a bounce from this party too. You know, like the guy that helped launch this. And it like to your point, it just got too much. It's like, damn, this is becoming like a very strong monthly bill for me to keep up with the story.
They weren't my favorite. Like they just started like losing me. And I couldn't tell. I was like, do I have to keep up with all of these titles? Like the Excalibur, the Fallen Angels, like where can I jump in and out of? And it was just hard for me to keep up. It does get, and because I don't have so much time, it does get intimidating. You know what I mean? Oh, like going in there. And then with the variants, it's like, do I have this one? Do I not have this one? Like I was actually going through my collection the other day because I was rebagging, reboarding. I bought some cool wooden crates for my office that I'm keeping the books in. They look really nice. And I realized I had bought like duplicates of certain issues just strictly off of the variants. Like I thought I had this. I didn't know that I had this. I was confused. Let me just grab it just in case I didn't have it. And I'm just like, man, I got like multiple copies of issues that I'm like, I don't even really care about just because I got kind of fooled by the variant. You know what I mean?
You know, you brought up Damian Scott a few times. And for those that are unaware, Damian Scott is a very well-respected and established comic book artist. He's worked for Marvel, DC. I think he even started up his own label, moved to Japan. Done very interesting story from based on what I gleaned. But, you know, you bring up that, you know, he was like a brother to you. You know, you guys grew up together. I guess, how does it feel knowing that you were able to live a dream and work in comics and have like published work with like the big two alongside him? Because if I'm not mistaken, among your comic bibliography, you've got you had a short story in the DC comic series Solo. That was a mid-2000 series. And then most recently, a short Silver Surfer story in the Marvel Voices comic book series in 2020. Both of them co-written and illustrated with Damian Scott. I mean, how awesome is that you got to do this with like your best friend that you grew up with reading comics?
Yeah, nah, that's fire. We always knew. It was never a doubt in my mind since 12 years old that Damian was going to be a comic book artist. I've never seen anybody dedicate themselves so much to a thing. I mean, even to this day, I mean, this is my family for real. Like we spend Thanksgivings together. Like, you know, we grew up across the street from each other. He'd sleep over my house when we were kids and stay for a week. You know what I'm saying? Like, he ate dinner with us. You know what I'm saying? It was like when we went on vacations, he came with us, you know, all types of stuff, man. So this is my brother for real. And we just knew, he'd always just had a pencil, a marker, or something in his hand. He'd drawn a napkin, he'd drawn a paper plate. You know, it was just whatever he can get his hands on. So we always knew. And then I was more into music. I was in the comics as well, but my creative outlet was music at the time. But I used to try to like draw my own comics and write my own comics. But he was just miles ahead of, you know, I started drawing, I sucked. He was miles ahead. It's just amazing. So to be able to work with him is a dream. You know, to me, true success is not just accomplishing your dreams, but being able to do it with the people that you love and the people that you came in with. It's more than a business relationship. So yeah, I did a 10-page story, a 10-page flash story in Solo 10 was the issue. And Solo was an artist focused series that DC had. So each issue of Solo, they would give to one artist. And it was an anthology of different stories, and they let the artist really be the creator and choose what characters they wanted to draw, chose who their writers were. And at this point, I was already a published journalist, so I did have experience writing, and people knew me as a writer. But Damian got the chance to do Solo 10 and was like, hey, Rob, you know, come do a story. Like, and so I wrote the Flash story. I look back at it, I cringe. It wasn't very good. Like, I was trying this social political kind of thing, and I don't know if it came across super well. I remember I was reading a review about the book, of the Solo book, like online, like on AOL. This is 2005, so this is like where we were at. And they were kind of like, they were like, yo, the book is good, it's dope. The Flash story is like, they dissed it, but they were like, oh, this last story is not great, but they were like, we think there's something missing. Like, it's definitely like worth revisiting. Like, there's something here, da da da. But it wasn't like great. And me and Damian talk about that all the time because like I just wish I could get a do over. But he gave me an opportunity, and I wrote that Flash story in 2005. When we fast forward to Marvel Voices, which I believe came out in 2020, that was actually my opportunity. Shout out to Chris Robinson, editor at Marvel, just came to me. And first he had came to me because they had put the Marvel hip-hop variants in a hardcover anthology. So Chris reached out and said, hey, can you give us a quote for the sleeve? So I think they asked like me, Peter Rosenberg, Killer Mike, LP, just like people in hip hop, just give us a quote on what you feel about Marvel hip hop variants, and we're going to put it on the sleeve of this hardcover. So that's how me and Chris Robinson met, and I gave him the quote, and then Chris Robinson was like, yo, we're having a premiere of Black Panther. You want to come to the premiere? Hell yeah. So me and Chris are getting cool. Chris is an amazing guy. And then Marvel Voices came out, and Chris was like, hey, would you like to write in this Marvel Voices anthology? I could give you 2 pages. You could pick whatever character you want. You can choose your artist, but we want you to write it. And I was like, amazing. And I said, well, can I pick Damian? You know, I'm trying to pay it forward. Damian gave me that shot in 2005. Now I have an opportunity that's based off of my name. Hey, man, I want Damian. And Chris was like, well, do you think we could get him? I know he's really busy because Damian had been working on other projects. I think Chris might have reached out for Damian to do some other stuff in his workload. Do you think we could get him? And I'm like, duh. Yeah.
Like, he's not gonna, yeah, I'm going to see him at Thanksgiving. I'll just ask him at the table.
Yeah. He's not going to say no to me. And they said I could have 2 pages and pick any character I want. Initially, my idea for the 2-page story was I wanted to do a story with Bishop from the X-Men, and I wanted to juxtapose it and do a scene from the movie Juice where Tupac played Bishop. So I wanted to take like a young Bishop in the future dystopian, like post-apocalyptic world, and he's kind of running to the streets like Pac, and I wanted to mirror a scene. And don't steal that. If anybody hears that, don't steal that, because I still think we can pull it off.
Have you ever seen the Mike Del Mundo Tupac Bishop drawing that he did?
No.
I'm going to send that to you, and it's going to blow your mind. And if there's anyone that you should get to do the story, it should might as well be Mike Del Mundo.
Okay, so I didn't know that. Clearly, this is a thing. This is like, you know how they say, like, no idea is original. Like, so somebody's thinking along these lines. But the reason why I didn't do the story, because I was like, damn, yes, we should get it because we're hip-hop, but that might be kind of niche. Can I use these 2 pages to just tell a more broader, relatable story? And really, I was getting gun-shy because I think the Flash story, I was trying to tell this story that maybe I didn't have the space or even the chops to tell back in 2005. So I said, man, let me just dial it back. Let me figure something out. And then at the time I was like, man, what scares the hell out of me? Like, what is the most terrifying thing to me? And I was like, fucking climate change. Like, what we're doing to this planet. Like, I don't know. I was in a wormhole of reading all of these articles about what's going to happen to us and our food supply and all of this. And I was like, damn, that's the real villain. That's like the real Thanos, right? At least to me, right? And, so I told a story about it with 2 pages and used Silver Surfer to help tell that story.
And I don't think there's any character better to tell that story than Silver Surfer, right? Like a character that falls in love with the human race because of our potential. Silver Surfer's always been very poetic and very drama focused. And I thought you nailed that story really well. And Damian Scott, obviously, man, his style is so unique. Graffiti, you know, there's a lot of graffiti influence, you know, it emits like just that hip hop soul to it. So yeah. I thought it was like a really good pairing of you two, and see like how far y'all came along, because respectfully, that Silver Surfer story is better than the Flash one, but I did see what you were going for the Flash. I just think that he's a character that, you know, can be challenging to write, like multi-dimensional, because, you know, he just gets a bad rep for just running fast.
Yeah. The Flash story, I was in over my head. Like, I'll admit that. Like, I just didn't have the writing chops either. And I tried to do something that I don't feel like it worked. But the Silver Surfer story, I remember I had a deadline too. I was just mulling over this story. I was really trying to get this Bishop story to work. I'm pushing the deadline. And when the Silver Surfer story came to me, it was really towards the end of what my deadline was. But when it came, like, everything just flowed. When I put pen to paper, it just flowed. And I know me and Damian talked about what we wanted to see. And you know, I told him what I wanted to see. I wrote a very detailed script, and he and his whole thing was just like, man, I'm going to support your vision. I see it. I get it. I understand it. Damian's amazing contribution besides the art, because, you know, I have wrote the script, but the one change that he made, and it was the absolute amazing call, is the panel where Silver Surfer is fighting Thanos with the rest of the Marvel heroes. Originally, when I wrote it, it was just Silver Surfer versus Thanos, because obviously they have a long history. So it was Silver Surfer versus Thanos, and it didn't have Captain America in it. It didn't have Rocket. It didn't have Scarlet Witch, Doctor Strange, none of that in it. And Damian was like, no, it needs to be like everybody. And I forget who it was. I think it was specifically Doctor Strange. She was like, plus I never drew Doctor Strange before.
So like, snuck it in, yeah.
He was like, no, it has to be everybody. And when he said it, I was like, yo, that was the absolute right call. So I think I went back to the script and I just changed because Surfer was talking very like singular. And I might have changed that part of the script to a we, you know, encompassing all the Marvel heroes. But that was Damian's contribution to the script, and he nailed it. And I'm so proud of how that came out. Like that's one of the things in my career that I'm the most proud of is working on that story. Marvel needs to holler at me, man. We got more work to do.
For sure, I can co-sign that. If you were given the opportunity to write any comic book character, who would you pick? And then who would be your artist? Like, if you could pick any artist, who would that be?
Spider-Man and Peter Parker, Spider-Man and Damian Scott. Like, it's just, and I'm not Easy. Even being, like, yeah, one, because, like, Damian has some Spider-Man work. He did a couple of issues. He did a spectacular Spider-Man about a 3-issue arc with the Lizard. He was bringing something to Spider-Man that I hadn't quite seen that I thought was so dope. Like Tom McFarlane, for example, right? Revolutionized Spider-Man with the eyes, right? The big bug eyes. And it was a change that really stuck for years with Spider-Man. Damian does something with the webbing on his costume and Spider-Man's fingers. Like it sounds weird, but his fingers. And Spider-Man's fingers as a point of focus, right? Because he's shooting with the webs, right? So his finger, like, I don't know that anybody has paid as close attention to detail in Spider-Man's fingers as Damian had in this 3-issue run of Spectacular Spider-Man. I thought it was amazing. I thought it like revolutionized the character. It kept something really classic and core to him, but gave us a new visual representation of it. I wanted my man to get more than a 3-issue run. So yes, if I could write something, it would be Spider-Man and it would be Damian. No. I'm going to look up the Spider-Man issues right now. My bad.
No, all good. All good.
I have it. I don't want to get off camera, but I have the trade. Like, just, if I was Mr. Fantastic, I'd be
happy. Rob, while you're doing that, I want to ask, do you have any difference in how you approach writing, say, a album review or article versus like comic books? Do you have to like tap into a different part of your brain, or is it at this point kind of like, you know, the same approach?
It's the same part of my brain and the same part of my heart, because I love them both. It's a different approach because the format is different, right? The mediums are a little bit different. But for me, it's all storytelling. Like, even writing album reviews, but or doing interviews and then writing an article, it's a form of storytelling. I'm interviewing somebody, gleaning information, and then I'm regurgitating that and weaving it into a story for the audience to read. So it's all a form of storytelling, and it all kind of comes just from the same place, but the approach is a little bit different. You know what I mean?
When you think about like comic book writers that might have inspired you, maybe subconsciously or consciously, what are some of those names?
Chris Claremont, for sure. That X-Men run. Again, I came in late on Claremont. Like, I got in about the Jim Lee era. But, like, that increased my vocabulary. Like, I used to, again, when your parents be like, oh, you're reading comic books, you're wasting time. So much of my vocabulary came from reading Chris Claremont. Because he wasn't necessarily writing for kids. Like,
hell no.
Some of those books, like X-Men 275 with the gatefold, I remember I had to read that book like 2 or 3 times to understand it. So Chris Claremont for sure. Saladin Ahmed, who you know, Spider-Man, and I did some work with him on a Dracula book.
Oh, cool.
As well. I helped co-write some stuff. His stuff is brilliant. I like a lot of Hickman stuff. And then again, I'm from that era. Tom McFarlane also. I think, man, Tom McFarlane, probably one of my favorite comic book stories. Well, my favorite comic book story, hands down, is Torment, is the first six issues of the Tom McFarlane Spider-Man series. It was so dark. Like what Todd was doing with Spider-Man, again, was revolutionary. He took this bright character that we usually saw in the daytime and you know, mild mannered Peter Parker, and really turned it dark. And then when he went on to do Spawn, it was like, oh, he was practicing for Spawn. Like that Spider-Man Torment series was, that could have easily been a Spawn story. Like, that was like a precursor for, you know, and then even the story after that with Wendigo and Wolverine and the child molester in Canada. I'm just like, yo, what am I reading? Like Spider-Man, like, chasing a child molester, and they thought it was Wendigo that was stealing the children, but they found out it was really some other guy. Like, it was dark stuff. But, like, at the time, it was, like, super revolutionary. So those guys for sure.
I remember reading that Torment series as a kid and realizing that Lizard would, I was like, man, nah, Lizard would be scary as hell if he was real. Like, you know, I think in that book, he eats someone, right? Like, he eats somebody?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Straight shook me.
And I loved it because it just took it out of this cartoon kind of era. Lizard and the way he drew Hobgoblin. Hobgoblin is still probably my favorite Spider-Man villain.
Especially when they introduced him in Maximum Carnage. It was a game changer for me.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And then real quick, I did look it up. That Damian, if you look at Spectacular Spider-Man number 11, it was the Lizard's Tale was the story arc. So it was the Spectacular Spider-Man series that started in 2003. But the Spectacular Spider-Man number 11, the Lizard's Tale part one, if you look at that cover.
Wow.
The way Damian draws.
Yeah, the knuckles and the. Yeah, no, that's because really impressive.
First of all, your knuckles don't exactly work like that or bend like that. But if anybody's did, it would be Peter Parker after getting bit by the spider. Like you know, even if you just look at the cover, it looks like spider legs.
I'm getting a lot of like a Humberto Ramos. I'm getting like some Trad Moore from this, like the way he plays with the angle and the perspective and the portions. Right.
So I thought there was some really interesting stuff here that I would have liked to see him expound upon. So just back to that question, if I got a chance, it would definitely be Peter Parker's Spider-Man, and it would be with Damian. Not just because he's my boy, like I have actual real reason to back it up. Like, I just think he could do some really amazing stuff with, no pun intended. He could do some really spectacular stuff with the character.
Rob, I want to turn the corner and talk a little bit about hip-hop and your contributions to the culture. Which, if we were to try to do that justice, I think we would need like a solid 48 hours to get through, you know, all of the achievements and things like that. But it's safe to say that you've interviewed anybody that is anybody in hip hop, from household names everyone knows like Jay-Z, Kendrick Lamar, Nipsey Hussle, Wiz Khalifa. You've even interviewed Mariah Carey.
Yeah.
Which already would make for an amazing highlight reel. But I challenged myself to see if I could find your first major publication or writing assignment. And I wasn't successful in finding like a copy online to read and reference, but I did find out that your first big published piece was an album review for Jadakiss in 2004, just in time for his second album, Kiss of Death. Considering that it's been almost 19 years since that first major writing assignment, and looking at where you're at now with, you know, all the different names and all the different people that you've interviewed and you've gotten to work with, do you ever look back at that first assignment, that first album review, and still feel something? Or has that moment been eclipsed with like 100 other moments? Like, is there still a lesson from that assignment that resonates with you that you still carry with you to this day? Or have you just grown so much that, you know, you're in a completely different headspace?
Yeah. That night, I was like, oh, this is what I want to do. It was like, oh, they let me in the door. They're going to have to bring me out on a stretcher. Like, you know, at the time I had graduated college and I was still working the job that I was working after high school, which was, you know, I was in the mailroom somewhere, and I would write freelance, you know, my free time when I wasn't working in the mailroom. And you know, they said, hey, you gotta go, you're gonna go up to Yonkers, the D block, and you know, somebody's gonna play you the Jada album, take notes, listen to it a couple of times, and then write your review. I didn't know that it was Jada that was gonna play it for me. And it was just me. It wasn't like, now they kind of do it like Junket, where people go in and go to an album listening. It was really just me in the studio and Jada was there. I remember Jin was there. Jin had just got signed to Rough Riders after his success on
Jin, that's a name I haven't heard in a minute.
Yeah, shout out to my man Jin. But I mean, I was locked in, I was zeroed in. So I'm stone faced. You know, I'm trying not to show no emotion. I didn't wanna, just in case I had to give Kiss a bad review, or like I didn't know what it was gonna sound like. So I'm like, man, let me just stay professional. But on the inside, I'm screaming. I'm like, yo, this is crazy. And then there's some amazing records on that album, like Why, like hearing Why for the first time was like incredibly powerful. There's records on that album that I love. To me, that's still my favorite Jada Kiss album, is The Kiss of Death. Once I did that, it was cool. I would have probably done it for free. I'm like, and they're going to pay me? And I was like, all right. They go, like, this is what I want to do for the rest of my career. Like, this is it. And so that's what I took away from it. Once I was in, I was like, I'm not getting out of this game. Like, they would literally have to kill me and bring me out on the stretcher for me to not do this for the rest of my life.
Wow. Powerful. I guess, what's it like knowing people out there, like, really value and respect your opinion and words on music? And how do you stay grounded and maintain that trust of your fans, knowing that you do have a relationship with artists and maybe you've befriended a few of them? Like, how do you stay grounded and true to who, you know, what got you here?
Yeah, I mean, you know, first is just I have gratitude to just know that people care about what I have to say, because there's everybody has a platform now. There's a ton of voices out there. So I have an immense gratitude that people care what I have to say. And with that gratitude and with that position comes responsibility. Like, one, I got to be true to myself. And then, but I got to be kind of true to my audience. Like, I can't, like, lie or fake something, you know? And I'm not a negative person. I'm also, you know, I do feel like the space has turned into the WWE. A lot. I know a lot of personalities. This whole thing is personality driven. So the guy who yells the most, the guy who bangs his fist on the table the most, the guy who says the most disrespectful thing is going to get the clicks, is going to go viral. That's who people are going to pay attention to. You know, that's not me. But I will get my point across. Like, I will, like, sometimes I'll say things, I'll just call it like I see it. You know, it just won't be a personal attack. Like, you know, like recently on the show, on the last episode of our Rotation Roundtable show, you know, I had to call out Soulja Boy for going at J. Cole. And it's like, hey, man, you sounding old and bitter. You're sounding like the guys that you used to go up against when you first came into the game. It wasn't flattering, but I didn't call Soulja Boy out his name. I didn't, you know, it wasn't like Soulja Boy's acting like a bitch. Da-da-da-da. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, there's still a way to articulate your point. So, I say all that to say I have gratitude, I have a responsibility, and I have respect for the audience and respect for the game at the end of the day. And, I think those are things that are, like, really, really important to me that I won't change for anybody, you know?
Well said. How much time would you say you spend listening to music? I imagine in your position, you know, that's like a requirement of the job, but like just rough estimate, how much time would you say you're spending listening to music, finding new artists, like doing that groundwork and that homework?
It's hard to quantify. It's not like I set time. It's just when you know, when I'm not in a Zoom meeting, when I'm not, you know, when the music is on, when there's nothing else going on, I could be going through emails and whatever, and I can listen to music. I watch NBA season started. I watch basketball. I put it on mute and I listen to music while I'm watching the game, driving. You know, I live in Jersey now, so I live further out from the city. So driving, listening to music, every chance that I get, I'm still listening to music. But, you know, I'm doing a lot of things, you know, and the genius, it's not just in front of the camera. Like, I'm on the executive side. I manage a team of multiple people. So it's meetings, it's one-to-ones, it's career building, it's, you know what I'm saying? Creative brainstorms. It's, you know what I'm saying? All that type of stuff. But every free chance I get, I'm listening to music. I'm listening to something. I'm trying to discover. I have a passion, particularly for new artists and just finding new talent and things of that nature. So, you know, all the time. And you know, it's disheartening because you get into this industry and you find out how many people in positions of power actually don't listen to the music, care about the music at all. It's just like backwards and I don't understand it.
When you think back to, you know, writing review, like heavily writing reviews and covering music, what was your process like? Like, did you have a ritual when it came time to like, okay, I need to listen to this album objectively and, you know, write my thoughts on it? Like, how do you get into that mindset versus just enjoying music, you know, just leisurely?
Yeah, it depends, right? Because there were different ways, especially in the times of the album reviews, which are less prevalent now. You don't need album reviews as much anymore because everybody's listening to it in real time. What made album reviews so valuable in the print journalism days is we would get the albums 30, 60 days, sometimes 90 days in advance and get to live with it or listen. So, for example, sometimes like in the situation with Jadakiss, I had to go to the studio and they played the album for me. So I couldn't take it home with me. So I had to send the album and they would play it. I'd probably listen to the album like three times. They would play it over and over again. And I'm sitting there with a pen and a pad already listening, taking it in, but trying to jot down what I feel that, oh, wow, this is what it made me feel. I'm trying to capture that. And so I can go home and don't forget. And I can take my notes and weave it into something. I'm trying to write down lyrics. If there was a particular a poignant line, I'm trying to describe in the moment how beats sound and things of that nature. So I'm taking notes. Even, you know, sometimes, like I said, I was one-on-one with Jadakiss at the time. Sometimes they would bring a bunch of journalists into the room and give you drinks and give you food and play the album. And then you had to write the review or whatever. And it became a social event. Even then, while everybody was socializing, I would find a corner near the speaker and I would just be there with my notepad, just taking notes. So that was my process. Really like a lot of note taking, just really trying to get my first ideas out, my first things out. So when I go home, I had notes to jog my memory about how I felt about the music and I could weave it into a review. Then there was sometimes when they would actually give us the album and we could live with it and formulate your review. And in those instances, I would live with it. I would play it while I'm cleaning the house. I would play it while I'm driving. I would play it like in everyday circumstances and live with it for a couple of days or a week and then write my review. And I've always had the music there that I can go back to as a reference. So I didn't have to take as much notes. I could just live with the music. So those were kind of the two ways of the process and how I prepared to write those.
Do you ever miss it? Or do you appreciate like the advancements that we've made as far as like technology and, you know, I guess the barrier of entry kind of like lowering as far as like, you know, music reviews and such. Like, do you miss those days?
I do miss it. I'm not upset at the barrier of entry being lowered, right? Like, I think accessibility for people is good. The fact of the matter is that everybody who access doesn't have respect for the music. You see it on social media all the time. Like, a Drake album will come out. And 15 minutes after it dropped, oh, this is a classic. Oh, this is his best album ever. And it's like, how? It's been 15 minutes. You didn't even listen to the whole thing. Like, do you just listen to music or you skim through it? I think with the access, the conversation around music has been devalued and become cheapened. And again, a lot of it is about the loudest voice in the room instead of the most articulate voice. And again, I'm not mad at the accessibility of it, but I'm mad that now we can't discern who really has respect for this and who doesn't. So I just wish people had more respect for it. So in a way, I do miss it. You know,
well said. So when you consider that there seems to be a lot of attention on hip hop history, and justifiably so. This year, 2023, marks 50 years of hip hop. You know, we're seeing a lot of attention to important dates, people sharing, you know, the years that meant a lot to them. Just last week, everyone was celebrating, you know, 30 years of Wu-Tang Entered the 36 Chambers and Tribe Called Quest Midnight Marauders, all dropping on the same day 30 years ago. And I want to ask if you personally have a standout year in hip hop, or maybe a specific moment in its 50 years, or just in your career specifically. that's a highlight for you or means something that means something special to you?
There's so many. You know, again, it starts probably in the 90s for me because that's that coming of age. Like when Illmatic drop was like a huge moment. So we're talking 94, but we're talking 95, the summer that Only Built for Cuban Links drop was like huge and definitive for me. But 2003 when 50 dropped Get Rich or Die Trying was an unforgettable time. You know, 2006 when Jay-Z celebrated the 10-year anniversary of Reasonable Doubt with a concert at Radio City Music Hall was something I got to attend as a professional review for XXL was a big moment for me. There's just been so many. You know, for me, though, it really maybe starts in the 90s. But, you know, So Far Gone, I think, was a game-changing moment when that came out. You know, I could just go on and on. But, yeah, it doesn't stop. You know, Good Kid, Mad City, like getting that album. And you know, at this time, I'm on the inside. I'm at MTV. But I remember having to fight for MTV to even interview Kendrick 3 days before his album came out. I said, hey, guys, I was in Vegas and Kendrick happened to be there. We were covering Lil Wayne and Birdman shoot, or could have just been Birdman video shoot. I was in Vegas, so we were doing behind the scenes video. And Kendrick happened to be in town performing in Vegas. So I said, oh, I'm going to go to the show. So I went to the show and then I called back at MTV. I called back the office. Hey, I need a camera person. I'm going to go with Kendrick to the studio after this show. Y'all, we need to interview him. And, you know, it was tough. It was like, we don't know if we have somebody available. Like, really? Like, is he that much big of a deal that, hey, it's I know it's 9 o'clock over there in the West Coast, but it's midnight. Like, really? You're calling at midnight for Kendrick? Like, who's Kendrick? Yo, this album is going to be a big deal. Like, this is important. And getting Cameron interviewing Kendrick, you know what I'm saying? So Good Kid, Bad City, just that whole week of release was super important. You know, being a part of the XXL freshman covers was super important. You know, covering Nipsey Hussle when I was at MTV when he dropped his $100 mixtape was just super important.
Rob, if I may ask, were you involved with the, was it 2009? The 2009 freshman cover for XXL. Were you at XXL at that time?
Which one was that? Was that the
Asher Roth, your yes. Charles? Yeah, okay. Yeah. That's, yep, I was there. I've got a few dates as far as like my personal hip hop celebration. Today is actually weirdly, oddly enough, on the day we're recording this, is one of them because it's like the 20-year anniversary of the Black Album and G-Unit's Beg for Mercy. It was the first time I convinced my mom to buy me rap albums. And so those albums hold like a special place in my heart. But the day that XXL freshman cover came out, that is a day that I won't forget because for me, it was like seeing these rappers that I was closely following on, you know, rap blogs, you know, your Blue, your Charles Hamilton, your Mickey Fats. As the years progressed, those XXL freshman covers kind of became like a point of contention for a lot of rap fans and debates. Like, I guess maybe this is just a general question on how you approach and handle like criticism and, you know, the online angry mobs and things like that. Like, how do you stay grounded in that regard and not letting that impact your day and your mental and you know, well-being?
I had to learn how to not let that impact me. But what I learned is, hey, if you don't like it, do better. Like, okay, now here's where the bar is. Like it's easy to criticize, do better, or do something. But you know, you're not going to please everybody. You know, what I would say is the freshman covers that I was a part of and there was point of contention about that 2009 cover too. I think it came out in 2008. Forecast in 2009, but I remember people were like, well, Ace Hood, I remember like Ace Hood caught a bad rap, but Ace Hood had hits and after, like, you know what I'm saying? Like Ace Hood had a run. You know, nobody's going to like 100% of what you do. I think at least me though, and nobody at my time at XXL, and I don't believe XXL does this now, but I can definitely speak for my time. There was never a meeting for any of the freshman covers that I did. And I did about three of them. Where people were like, oh, let's pick this person because that's really going to get, that's going to piss people off. That's going to get people talking. Like it wasn't trying to troll. The fact is that the industry doesn't support 10 new careers every year. like 10 new rap artists don't blow up every year. So some people are not going to make it. Some people it's going to take longer than others. But the idea was that as a rap fan, you could find at least somebody on that cover that you like and identify with. And if you can't, out of those 10 artists, find an artist that you can champion, the problem is not the cover. The problem is you as a fan, you know, and that's the way that I always approached it. But I think we always try to do the right thing. I remember the year, and we would get criticisms. I remember the year that we put YG on the cover. And this is like when YouTube started really first becoming important. I couldn't believe the amount of traffic that Tooted and Booted was getting. Like, you know, now that we look at it, it's not the most memorable YG song that, you know, but Tooted and Booted was a moment, not just for LA, but for the internet. And I remember just how it traveled on YouTube. And I remember somebody writing an article. I know who it was, so I remember we actually argued about this on Twitter once. But so, you know, I'm not even going to go there. But there was an article written, you know, they used to grade the freshmen. And I think we got like a D or something for picking YG. And they were like, oh, this is Def Jam payola. Def Jam paid for this. No, Def Jam didn't. Like, we picked YG. I don't think his budget had even opened yet, because when you look at that freshman cover and then My Crazy Life came out, it was years. It was at least a year, maybe 2 years before it came out. They hadn't opened his budget. I don't think Def Jam, they had just signed YG, but I don't think they cared very much or really had a plan in place. There was no money exchange. There was no favor being done. Like, YG was on that cover because he was popping. And I remember getting dissed because YG was on the cover and they said, we took money, we took payola, this and that. And then when he dropped My Crazy Life, that was the first album, right? My Crazy Life. When he dropped the first album and the album was a classic, like it was just a banger. There was such a feeling of vindication. It was like, oh, this is the guy that they said we took money from. No, because we knew what the potential was. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, for some guys, it doesn't happen right away. Some guys, it takes a year or it takes 2 years or whatever. So you're always going to get criticism, but do better. You know, I used to be on MTV's Hottest MCs list too, and people would criticize us for the picks that we made. I've had people call for my job. Oh, he should be fired. Oh, he doesn't know what he's talking about. Oh, this, oh, that. And sometimes I've gotten it wrong. Like, there's absolutely times when I've gotten it wrong, but I consistently know what I'm talking about. And there are few people with a track record like mine. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's an elite class. So, you know, it's just raising the bar. If you feel you could do better than me, do better. And then we're going to be in a great place. Like, I encourage you to do better, because that's going to make sure that the culture is in a great place. If somebody can come across and do this job better than me, please, I welcome it. Like, and there are people out there who can be better than me. I'm not saying I can't be top, but it raises the bar. So I brought it to this level. Who's going to come and take it another level? Let's do it, because the game is going to be better off.
I will say one thing about those covers and the Hottest MC. I forgot all about that. You feel like you just unlocked the memory with that. Regardless of if I agreed with everything or not, it got me talking, and it felt like it brought, you know, it got me talking with my friends and, you know, having that conversation. I feel like brought us closer in the sense of like learning where all of us were at, like musically and, you know, what certain, you know, who we liked and why we liked them. So yeah, those are some fond memories for me. And, you know, hearing you talk about raising the bar and, you know, doing better, who are some who you would consider your peers or people that motivate you from that journalistic, you know, perspective and that writing perspective? Like, what names come to mind? Like, who do you look at? Like, okay, he's doing something really dope and, you know, I want to strive, you know, he's pushing me to become better.
Sway, you know, starts with Sway for me. Obviously my OG, he's a mentor to me. Daytuan Thomas, these are guys who came before me. Even Elliot, I know people will see me and Elliot go back and forth, not in the best way, but Elliot is a guy who set a mark, who raised the game, who elevated the game, and so absolutely inspired by Elliot. Angie Martinez, you know, these are just some of the people that came before me. Me and B-Dot are peers. We came in at the same time, so I look at what B-Dot is doing. I just saw Wayno, my brother Wayno Clark, just interviewed Tyler the Creator.
Oh, wow.
On Amazon live stream at Camp Flognaw. And I was so inspired when I seen like Wayno sitting with Tyler, just, oh man, I got to step my game up. One, I was happy for my man. I was seeing what was going on, But I'm like, yo, okay, this inspires me to do better. There's more to do. Let's go. So shout out to Wayno. Jinx. I think Jinx is absolutely brilliant. You know, I love what Jinx is doing. You know, Mouse Jones is somebody who I'm a fan of too. These are guys that are younger than me that I still look at. And like, you know, my man Armand, also, I think he's super dope. So, you know, these are cats who inspire me.
What makes for a good interview? Like, are there any elements that you think every interview should somehow incorporate or topics touch on? Like, what would you say to that?
I mean, well, one, preparedness on both sides, but preparedness for me as a journalist, so just to be prepared and knowledgeable and know what I'm talking about. A willingness and an openness from the other side. Like you can't force anybody to talk. I can't beat an answer out of you. So you got to want to be there. I often tell publicists, there's some artists who just don't enjoy doing interviews. And I often tell publicists, look, if they don't want to be there, don't send them. It's not an indictment on them. Some people just aren't good at it or don't enjoy it. It doesn't make them less of a great artist. It doesn't make, let's not force it. You know, one interview that I had that was particularly tough was with Rich the Kid for XXL. I'm sorry, not for XXL, for Genius, for a show that we used to do called IRL. And I look at it and I cringe. It just seemed to me that he didn't want to be there, or he didn't take it very seriously, or he wasn't prepared or willing to talk that day. And it's published, it's out there, and I can't even watch it. I wish I could get it back. And that was an interview that he and his team asked for. Yo, we want this. And I prepared to give Rich. I thought I had prepared an interview to have a conversation with Rich the Kid that he's never had before, that could have really shed some light on who he is and how he is and how he came up and what's important to him and what makes him tick. And he didn't want to answer any of the questions. He didn't want to really kind of be there or part of it. And, oh man, I cringe. And it still got 1 million views. I hate it.
You're like, damn it. 1 million people watch this shit. Damn it.
Yeah. But, you know, I've had some really great interviews. I've been blessed. That same series IRL that we did with Genius was a series I created. There's an episode where we took 21 Savage out to a blacksmith and remade the knife that he has tattooed, the dagger that he has tattooed.
Oh, that's a dope concept.
Yeah. And this was the whole, this is before the album came out.
Huh.
And this is the whole, it's a knife era, you know, the whole, it's a knife meme. So I'm let's actually make the knife. But the thing was, everybody on the internet was making fun of it, but that tattoo had real significance and a connection to 21's brother who passed away. You know what I'm saying? So there was a real story behind it. So I'm like, yo, let's explore this. And at the same time, the B-roll of the interview was us. It was a raw piece of steel. And we forged it into a replica of the dagger that he, of the knife that he has.
Wow.
You know, tattooed on him. So
I got to find this.
Yeah. You know, I did an interview with Camila Cabello from Fifth Harmony after she left the group and then embarking on a solo career. And nobody knows that. We think she's going to be a star, but it's not promised, right? It's you leave in a really successful group and say, hey, I'm going solo. So now it's on you. So I took her and we did an interview and we talked about that and we were getting her cards read to tell her future. So, you know what I'm saying? Like, I've done incredible, like, powerful interviews that I'm super proud of. My Kendrick Lamar to Pimp a Butterfly interview is one of my favorites. Incredibly powerful. My Mariah Carey interview is one of my favorites. Incredibly powerful. So, you know,
can I add one to that list? I remember kind of tuning in for this. It was on Twitter Spaces. I want to say 2020, 2021. I think you jumped in or you were hosting Alicia Keys. And then I think Jay hopped on. You facilitated that so well. We're talking, and I want to say maybe DJ Khaled was on it or maybe that was a separate one. But the way you were facilitating both, you know, putting the spotlight on Alicia Keys. I think she was dropping an album and then Jay hopped on to support. And, you know, you were juggling both really well and giving them ample time. And I was really impressed by that. And then today I learned through this interview that, you know, you basically freestyled that. And I was like, damn, that really kind of speaks to, you know, just, you know, how ingrained he is that, you know, I think for anyone else, they would want plenty of prep time. You know, they would probably want to tackle that one-on-one. But the fact that you were able to just jump in and, you know, kind of like showcase you being a master at your craft was really impressive.
Yeah. Well, there were two of them. So the Alicia Keys one was planned. Alicia was promoting an album and Jay was going to jump on. I found out maybe the day before.
Got it.
That
okay.
Jay was going to be there. So I had a little time to prepare because it was just supposed to be me and Alicia, and they said, and a special guest. The publicist was like, you, Alicia, and there's a special guest. My dumb ass, I didn't even ask who the special guest was for me. It's me and Alicia, dog. All I heard was me and Alicia.
That's good enough. One of my favorites.
I thought it was either going to be Swizz Beatz, who's mm-hmm. special, for right? Sure. Or Mike Will had produced that album for Alicia. So I thought it was going to be Mike Will, who's my man. That's easy. That's cake. But me and Alicia, I'm locked in. And then I got a call the day before, and Alicia was like, yo, I just want to make sure you're prepared. And I was like, yeah, no, I'm good. And she was like, and you know who the guest, they told you about the guest. I was like, you know what? I ain't even asked. I was like, I thought it was Swizz. And she was like, no, my husband is special. Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
He's absolutely special. But Hove is going to join us. And I'm like, holy shit. And so I did have time to prepare for that one. But what I wanted to do, as much as I wanted to ask about Hove so many questions, it was Alicia Keys' moment. It was Alicia mm-hmm. Keys' album. And I wanted to make sure that she had space as well. And it didn't turn into the Jay-Z show. You know what I'm saying? So that was great. And Jay dropped a lot of gems.
Oh, yeah. Was that the interview or was it the Khaled one where you brought up the fact that he ghost wrote Still Dre? And I think you had asked, like, hey, do you have a version of that? He was like, yeah, but that's tucked away, which was major.
Yeah,
I mean,
that was in the Alicia one. Yeah. And then I think he talked about a conversation with him and Lucy and Grant. Like, that was just a great episode, a great conversation with Alicia. And they were talking about independence because Alicia became independent from that and all of that. It was great. The Khaled one, I didn't know Jay was coming.
The
Khaled one was Lenny has hit me and said, yo, Khaled is doing the Twitter spaces. Can you moderate this with him? And I said, absolutely. Like, those are my peoples. I love Khaled. So I did the thing. And first, and it's just me and Khaled talking. The first LL comes on. So we're wow. giving space to LL. And I'm like, dog, this is, and I had never interviewed or spoken to L before. And I'm like, dog, this LL, dog, this is crazy. And then Jay jumps in. I didn't know Jay was coming. And I freestyled that whole point. But at the same time, trying to direct traffic and make sure Khaled's a part of the conversation to the point that Khaled got mad at me. I saw a lot of people on Twitter was like, why he keep asking Khaled questions? Jay is there. And I'm like, well, no. This is... Like, first of all, let's be clear. And I love and I respect Jay. And I believe that Jay has a respect for me and what I do. Through our interactions, that wasn't the first time. That wasn't the second time that I've interviewed Jay. But the whole reason I'm talking to Jay at this point is because of Khaled and Lenny S. So let's not forget what got us here. Let's not forget why we're here. I know when Jay comes into the room, it's a different thing, but we're going to respect DJ Khaled as well. But then Khaled was like, dog, why? Why you keep asking me questions? Jay is here. Like, I don't want to talk no more. Just you and Jay just talk. Like, I was trying to be respectful. Awesome. Even Khaled was like, no, when Jay-Z is talking, you just get out the way. So it was funny. But that was a freestyle. That was Jay was there. And just off the top of my head, it's just like, well, what can we talk about? And, you know, it was a dope conversation. I hope before my career has ended that I could really get the proper Jay-Z one-on-one sit down. With cameras, I have questions. I have things that I want to ask him if he's willing that he hasn't talked about. I think we could cover new ground and give people a new experience, a new insight into what make Hove tick. But, you know, if I never get that one, man, that the Khaled talk, the Alicia Keys talk, the times that I've talked to him on the red carpet at MTV were pretty special, man. So,
man, that sounds like like I said, those two interviews, masterful performance, man. Like, I applaud you, and those were fantastic. Is there anyone that you haven't interviewed that's on, like, your list? Like, do you have a list of, like, I got to get these interviews, you know, before I leave this earth? Like, who's still on that list?
Probably, I still, that Jay one-on-one interview, like, sure. that is one-to-one Jay-Z interview for sure. Andre 3000. I've never interviewed 3 Stacks. I've never interviewed Eminem.
Okay.
I met Eminem on 2 occasions, but I've never interviewed him. And then, again, to the degree that he's open, to the degree that he's willing to talk open and honestly, Diddy.
Hmm.
I think I could do like in my head, like I have a crazy Diddy. I have a crazy line of questions for Diddy.
What's harder, being a journalist, on screen personality / interviewer, being a comic book writer, or being a rapper?
Comic writing is probably the hardest for me now. You know, there's a bit of imposter syndrome sometimes when I get into it. Hip hop, I know, like the back of my hand. Comic books I do too, but it's more from a fan's perspective. Like I'm still kind of just getting my feet wet into writing. So probably comic book writing is the hardest.
And I guess this is a good transition to your music career. Cause like I said at the top, you know, you've got 3 full length albums, you've got a handful of singles and EPs. And correct me if I'm wrong here, but most of your, if not all your music is distributed or under the label Right to Dream, right? And that's your thing?
Yeah, Right to Dream is my company.
Because I'm noticing the chain, Right to Dream, and that's a comic book thought bubble, right?
Mm-hmm.
So even then, so even in your music, you were able to kind of like, you know, inject some of your, you know, your passions, your hobbies into it as well.
Yeah, most people never pick up on that. The logo is designed by Damian Scott. I told him what I wanted, and he designed it, and we came up with it together. But yeah, Right to Dream, because you know it's a double entendre. Like literally, like my medium is writing, whether it's writing articles, right, interviews, comic books, rhymes. Right to Dream, like that's how I get to these dreams is by writing them out. But also, you have a right to dream, and nobody has the right to step on your dream. So it's a double entendre. But, you know, so often we're judged. So many people dream of things and don't vocalize it because they're afraid of the judgment. And that's the significance of the thought bubble. The thought bubble in comics represents things that we say but never verbalize, things that we say to ourselves but never verbalize. And I think every dream before you become Jay-Z, and everybody has this story, but it starts here. It starts with an internal conversation. You know what I'm saying? Jay-Z tells the story of his uncle was like, you'll never be a million records. You'll never sell a million records. Like, who do you think you are? And then he goes on, you know, to become Jay-Z. There's always going to be somebody who kind of doubts you on your way, but it starts with the fortitude in hearing what you tell yourself. So that's what Right to Dream represents for me. And that's the whole metaphor of it.
That's dope. I was listening to, you know, I was catching up on the music and I was listening. I think I ran Fake Chains, which I think is the latest single that you've put out with Devious Minds on production. I think I ran that back like 5-6 times. What are your intentions with like the music career? Is it a creative outlet for you, or do you have bigger dreams, you know, considering that, you know, you're so ingrained in the culture and you spend so much time around musicians and artists?
Yes and yes. The music for me is definitely an outlet for expression. It is the truest thing where I feel like I could totally be myself and say what I want to say. There are things that I'm comfortable saying in the music or expressing in the music that I can't say anywhere else. If I'm sitting down with Kendrick Lamar and speaking to him about To Pimp a Butterfly, it's not about me. You know what I'm saying? It's about him. So it's me. It's storytelling, but it's about his story. But I have stories I want to tell too. So it's a way to put myself front and center and express things and get things off my chest. And it's a form of therapy. So first and foremost, that's what it is. First and foremost, the music has already done for me what I needed it to do. It was to be an outlet. But yes, I do have bigger dreams and bigger intentions. Like, I want the world to hear it. Of course I want, but I'm grateful for it being out and existing and for me having the audience that I have and the people who listen, I'm grateful. But yes, I want more. And, you know, I kind of feel like I'll get there. This is a whole different thing, but I don't know that I might not be here. Or I might not be actively making music. I feel like when it's truly appreciated, when people go back and be like, oh shit, like he really did that. You know what I'm saying? Like, I think it might take a little more time, but that's not my job right now. My job is to create and put it out. And I'm grateful doing that.
Did you face any like obstacles from the industry when you decided to like, you know, put your music, you know, face forward for the public, you know, cause I can imagine, you know, with you, you know, you brought up, for example, like, you know, your time at XXL and, you know, being accused of payola and maybe favoritism or whatnot. Like, did you face any similar obstacles when it came to, you know, stepping out as your own artist?
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, because even when I was at XXL, I was doing music. I had music on the blogs and Two Dope Boys and that, right? You know, I wasn't as popular as Mickey Fax. Me and Mickey Fax actually had a song back in the day. But you know, I was there under a different name, and I wasn't trying to hide it, but there was definitely, you know, it was put to me by someone while I was working at XXL that I had to choose either my music or my job, because they were going to cut my job because they didn't like the way it looked. It was a conflict of interest. It was this, it was that. So I chose my job because I had two kids to feed. So that was one obstacle. And then when I was putting the music out, you know, I had people close to me, people like the story of Jay-Z's uncle, "You'll never sell, right? What are you doing?" I've had people in my family being like, "Nah, you shouldn't put that out." I've had people who I know love me. You know, rest in peace to Mac Miller. He's a friend of mine and obviously an amazing artist and somebody who I look up to and who inspired me, and he's younger than me. And so I told him about my plan to put out the music. I actually had a different plan back then. What I was going to do was I was going to put out a book called Right to Dream. And then the audio version of the book was going to be music.
Oh, that'd be cool.
So it was going to be like this hidden thing. And I was telling him the concept. And he was like, "Yo, that's fire." But he was like, "Yo, I don't think you should put out the music." And it wasn't that he wasn't trying to hurt me. I get it. He was just like, he just didn't want to see my thing tainted is what he was saying. He was like, "Yo, people respect you for that. It's just going to be a much harder role for you. People are going to be way harder for you on you and your music because of who you are." And rest in peace to Mac. And when I went and I put Right to Dream out anyway, I had never put out the book, but I put out the first album. And when it came out, the day it came out, he said, "Damn, I'm glad you didn't listen to me."
Wow.
He was like, "Man, you did it like your way. Like, that's dope." You know what I'm saying? So, there was opposition, both, I think maybe malicious from people who didn't understand. And then there were people who loved me who were kind of like, "Dog, I don't know." You know what I'm saying? Who I know love me. And there's no doubt that, you know, it's people in my family. Again, you know, me and Mac were really close friends. And so, but, you know, I had to do it for me, regardless of what the outside noise was.
I think this is an applicable time to bring up this quote from you that I found. You say that you have this concept called the invincible dream. There's a lot of people who told me not to do it. There are plenty of people who told me that I was wasting my time listening to this music, and I have preserved. If you dream it, you can get it. That is what I have learned from this. If you work hard and you dream, you can get it. There's a power within yourself. If you want it, you can get it. Do you mind building on that? And specifically, giving advice to people listening right now that aspire to be, you know, maybe the next Rob Markman, or be in a position to be writing, you know, full time. Like, do you have any advice that would have been helpful for you to hear, you know, when you first started out?
Just keep going. You know, even with my music stuff, I stopped, picked it back up. You know, I have been doing music for years, even before writing. I stopped, picked it back up. Probably wasted time living in doubt and living in fear of what other people were saying, living in judgment and worried. I think those are dream killers. Keep going. Give yourself grace. And you may not be the best at it now. You know, one of the things that stops us is that, you know, we also, like, I'm fucking dope as a rapper. Like, I know it. Do I have room to grow? Like, again, if the bar, my favorite is Hov, if the bar is Jay-Z, if the bar is Drake, do I have room to grow? If the lyrical bar is Kendrick, do I have room to grow and do I have room to get better? Absolutely. But I'm fucking dope. So I'm putting it out now. Like, you know what I'm saying? And then we're going to continue to evolve. It's okay to evolve in real time. It's okay to put your stuff out. Tomorrow's not promised. Like, don't live with regret. You know, you just never know what's on the other side of that. Again, I haven't sold a million records, but I know what my records mean to people. You know, I've had people come to me and say, you know, I've had one person in particular say that they were on the verge of suicide until they heard a record that I wrote, and it convinced them that they had something more to live for.
Wow.
Like, so literally, if my thing could save one person, like if it meant that much to one person, yeah, I would like a Grammy. Yeah, I would like to sell a million. But though, like, this is tangible. Like, this is somebody's life. This is our life. So I would tell, just keep going. Just do it. There's an audience out there for you. We hear some of the most terrible rappers in the world. There's some really
garbage journalists, and there's space for them too. So don't be so hard on yourself. You know what I'm saying? It was something, here's something that maybe even is more relatable. The first time I took the driver's test, I failed. You know what I'm saying? And I was like, damn, I'm never going to get my license. But then you kind of look, you know how many idiots have their license? I'm like, this is not unattainable. Like, you know what I'm saying? I'm like, anybody can get a license. You just got to kind of position yourself. Like, there's people that I know, they're not better than me. They're not smarter than me. They're not more well-equipped than me, and they got their license. So the first time I fail, you might fail the first time is what I'm saying. But it's all right. You got to keep at it. The first time I tried to get my license, I failed, and I felt like shit. But then I was like, nah, dog, I know I could drive better than that person, man. I'm going to go back and get my license. So go back and get your license, man. Like, you know, man, it's possible.
Go back and get your license. I love that. And I thought I was the only one that failed the driver's test on its first. Actually, I failed, if I'm being 100% real with y'all, I failed twice and passed it on my third time.
But imagine if you give up after two. You're taking the bus for the rest of your life.
Exactly.
Like your Uber bill is crazy. Like no matter what, just keep going, man. It's like,
go get your license. I love that.
Rob, I feel like this is such a cliche question to ask, but I feel like I'd be missing a very easy layup if I didn't ask this, considering that you just brought up Hov as one of your favorite MCs. Who else is in your top five MCs?
Yeah, my top five rappers are, and these are my personal favorites, not my, because sometimes there's two lists. There's like
the objective list and the personal list.
Very objective and personal. But my personal list is Jay-Z, Nas, Big, Pac, and Scarface.
The Scarface is a nice round out for sure.
Yeah. I mean, Scarface, I have very personal connections to his music. It came at a time in my life when I really needed it. And Jay just being the ultimate. I'll tell you a quick story before I get into the Mount Rushmore about Jay. Or just, you know, you brought up Fake Chains. And Fake Chains really for me is a song about not what it seems on the surface, but it is me stunting a little bit. The song, the hook is, I'd rather have no chains than fake chains. So I'm out here, I'm at a point where I'm getting money. I don't have the biggest chain, but I'm able to ice my shit out, custom piece, like it's mine. Like, but I'd rather have no, if it's not real, I don't want it. I'd rather have no chains for fake chain than fake chains. But you know, this Right to Dream piece, when I got it, I've always wanted a Rockefeller piece. Like, to me, Rockefeller has the best chain in the game.
Iconic.
Yeah, I'm going to get a Rockefeller chain. I'm going to get a Rockefeller chain. One day, somehow, some way. I get to a certain point, dog, I'm not getting a Rockefeller chain. It's not happening. But I got to write the dream chain. It's cool. I was at the Hove, at the Book of Hove event, and Just Blaze comes up to me. And you know, Just Blaze is a huge comic book fan, but Just Blaze comes up to me, and he's wearing his Rockefeller chain. I'm wearing my Write the Dream chain. And Just Blaze is like, yo, that's a dope chain, dog. Like, I like that chain. Like, yo, and it got like a little comic book thing going on too. He got it right away.
Hell yeah.
So just that validation for Just Blaze from somebody so instrumental with the Rockefeller and Jay-Z is seeing that was like, that shit meant the world to me. I'm like, ah, he gets it. Like, I'll never get the Rock chain, but I got to write the Dream chain. I'm good.
The listeners know you're talking to a huge Jay fan. I just got one question to interject. Do you got a top five Jay songs?
I never thought about a top five Jay song, but Dead Presidents is my favorite.
Okay. Wow. It's a tough one.
My top five, I'll give you my top five Jay songs today.
Yeah, that just come to mind. That's all good.
Dead Presidents, that doesn't change. Dead Presidents, number one. Streets is Watching. I've been listening to a lot of Volume 1 lately. So Streets is Watching. Oof. This is tough, bro.
It is. Because you know what's going to happen is regardless of what your answers are, when we hit stop, you're going to be like, God damn it, how could I forget that one? You know, how could I forget Can I Live or whatever?
Yeah. What did I say? I said Dead Presidents. I said Streets is Watching. PSA.
Good choice. Two more. Give me two more.
Yeah. Just off of his verse, off of Do It Again.
Oh, that's a good one. Okay.
Yeah, you got a little dough. That's cool with me. You got a little flow. That's cool with me. None of y'all motherfuckers cool with me. Rich Frostbite minus 2 degrees, about as blue as the ceiling. That verse is so crazy. And that's just strictly off of that verse. That's crazy. That's one I'm going to regret, but that's crazy. Oh, and where I'm from.
Solid. You know what? I'll give you a round of applause for taking on that challenge. Well
it's
done.
It's going to change tomorrow.
Is it safe to say that Reasonable Doubt is your favorite album?
No.
No, really? Okay.
Because I flip-flop between Reasonable Doubt and Blueprint.
And you know what? Among any of the ones that you would want to flip-flop, I think Blueprint would definitely be a great contender for Reasonable Doubt. Reasonable Doubt for me for a lot of personal reasons, but also just because it's a goddamn classic. And Brooklyn Fine is like honestly one of my all-time favorite hip-hop songs ever.
Wait, no. Okay, we're going to have to go back. I'm doing this five again. Hold on. I'm doing Dead Presidents, right? I'm doing Streets Is Watching.
Okay.
I'm doing PSA. Okay. I'm doing Brooklyn's Finest. I'm doing Where I'm From.
All right. Solid. Solid. I'm glad I got the help a little bit.
You're right. No, you have. I stole that one from you.
All right. Now shifting back to comic books, when you think of your all-time favorite comic book artist, and if you had to make a Mount Rushmore, which is only four, but if you got five, feel free to give me five.
Yeah, not four.
What comic artists are in your Mount Rushmore?
Todd McFarlane, Jim Lee. I'm going Damian Scott. Got a rep for my Hell boy. Yeah. Who is in that fourth spot? Wow, this is tough. Todd McFarlane, Jim Lee, Damian Scott. And I know I'm gonna pick somebody and then I'm gonna forget somebody, but right now I'm gonna go with Mark Silvestri.
Nice. Mark Silvestri is the quintessential Wolverine artist for me. So like when I think about Wolverine, it's him. It's either him or Jim Lee. But his X-Men run when they were in like Australia and stuff is iconic. Solid picks. Rob, I feel like I've been extremely fortunate to have so much of your time. Honestly, I've got a ton of other questions I could ask. I guess I got one more question just to like link back to what you got currently going on. So this Flatbush Zombies 3001, a prequel odyssey, you're doing a signing for that December 2nd at Bulletproof Comics in Brooklyn. Do you want to speak just quickly about this comic book? I know it's like a prequel to the same group's debut album. Like, is the book kind of essentially about their origin or what can you talk about?
Yeah, no, well, you know, with the book, the whole thing about the album, it stemmed from the album cover, from 3001 album cover, drawn by Nakamura. They were presented almost as superheroes. They were presented as superheroes, not almost as superheroes, as superheroes on the album cover. So it was really taking that image and saying, well, how did they get these powers? Who are these, who's Meech, who's Eric, who's Juice? Like, how did they get to this point where they had these powers? So we built a story around that and centered it in Flatbush, Brooklyn. I'm from Flatbush, Brooklyn. And so we made it a real community-based story and centered it. You know, one of the highlights every year that happens in our community, in our borough, is the West Indian Day Parade. Flatbush is a heavy, heavy West Indian Day. It's a heavy, heavy West Indian neighborhood where I grew up, where the Zombies grew up. And, you know, the night before the parade is an event, Juve, which lasts through the night. So the whole story kind of takes place and unfolds the night of Juve, and the final battle happens during the West Indian Day Parade on Labor Day. And within the comic, you know, we explain how they got their powers. And we even have Bulletproof Comic where we're doing the signing. Hank, who is the owner, is actually a character in the novel, and where the Zombies actually hide out and learn about their powers is in the back room in the comic shop. If you know about Bulletproof, they have different rooms and stuff like that. So wrote Hank and wrote Bulletproof into the story because that's such a staple of the community. It was a community-based story. It was written by me. It was illustrated by JJ Lopez, who will also be at the signing. And then we're doing a re-release with a variant cover, a Bulletproof exclusive, with a cover by Damian Scott, who is also from Flatbush. And on December 2nd, myself, Damian, all three of the Flatbush Zombies, Meech, Juice, Eric, and JJ Lopez will all be at the comic book store signing. And it is a CGC event, so I think you'll be able to send your books off to
CGC. Oh, wow, that's dope.
And get them graded, so.
Look, if you are in the area, there's no reason for you not to attend. And if you do attend, send me a pic, all right? I won't be able to, but if you're in the area, please attend. Rob, this has been fantastic. I'm going to have links to your socials and website in the show notes. But is there anything that you want to leave off with? Do you have anything to plug or share to the listeners before we sign off?
Nah, I'm not so much of a self-promoter. Like, it's just, you follow me on socials, you'll be able to keep up. But, you know, this is a culture, this is something that I love deeply. Like, you know, comics is a passion of mine. It brings me peace when the day gets stressful. Like, I'm sitting in my office now. You can't see on the other side of this is my whole comic collections. I got some slabs hanging on the wall. And if I'm stressed or whatever, like, I could kind of just look around and it brings me peace and comfort. So to be a part of this was super dope, to be a part of your platform. I'm very grateful.
Man, much appreciated. Look, if you ever have any comic projects in the future, you know, you've got the open door. Open door policy for you. Feel free to come back and be prepared for some more Jay-Z trivia and question.
Nah, that's love. Thank you.